Do we have any questions?
Yes. In the purification ceremony at the end, it says, by the grace of the masters, you are free. I'm wondering why it's like that, because that seems, with you saying by the grace, it seems passive rather than something like, let the grace of the masters set you free, which is a more active, that you have to do it along with the masters.
Okay, so this is a question that John has asked me before, and I told him I would answer it, and it seems a little complicated, so I wanted to just sort of give it to the whole class, because it, let me just explain to you, a few of you don't know, one of the, Swami Kriyananda wrote a number of ceremonies. The one that we really know the most is the Festival of Light, which we do every Sunday service. But another ceremony they wrote is called the Purification Ceremony, and it is, he actually even put a little note, he called it in lieu of confession, meaning that he was sort of writing something, the festival was like a mass, and this was a ritual that takes the place of that, I mean, being the Catholic Church, being the definition of religion. That was sort of a joke. But the concept of confession is that you enumerate all those things that are wrong with you. And from a karmic point of view, which is what we're talking about, the last thing you want to be doing is affirming your flaws. The whole approach of Christianity, especially Catholicism, is that we are we're mortal sinners, and by the grace of Jesus Christ, we were redeemed from our sinful state. But that without the intercession of the Jesus Christ specifically, we're hopeless. The entire perspective of self-realization is a complete flip of that, that our true nature is divine, that we are always divine, that we become confused and fall into a state of ignorance. And so we're in a state of ignorance, but all we have to do is not be ignorant anymore, and our fundamental nature is free. It's so entirely different, it's extremely important to really understand that, which is your spiritual salvation is guaranteed. You are always in the presence of God. You are always one with God. All you have to do is realize that. That's where the teaching is called self-realization. It's not like it's not even self-salvation or anything like that. It's just you have to just realize what's happening. Now think how often in your life you just suddenly realize what's going on, right? Like nothing has changed. Everything is just as it always was. But suddenly you realize what's actually going on. You know, you realize that people are making fun of you. You realize that people like you. You realize that you're actually quite good at this. You realize that you're in love with someone. You realize that you're not in love with them. But whatever it is, it's just a fact, and you come to know it. And nothing has changed except your inner consciousness. So the fact that this path is called self-realization means that the divine self is always there and that gradually we come to realize that. You see how very different that is from the fact that we're hopelessly sinners, that we're, you know, from the animals born, and the whole religion being predisposed toward a sinful definition of human consciousness has really fallen into the teachings of Darwin, you know, really deeply, that fundamental Christian theology does not accept that we ascended from the animals because they don't accept evolution. But the idea that the animal nature is our true nature and only by the intercession of Christ is the one usually, are we actually just freed from that? But we're made into something that we aren't naturally. That's why those who don't accept Christ are just damned forever, because that's our natural condition. You see how it all follows? Whereas when you start with self-realization, everyone is a child of God, and some people wander around in ignorance for a long time, and others sort of make the effort, and they gradually know it. But all you do is just find out what's true. And so even ourselves, as we work with it, we have to really constantly understand, we have to constantly be reminding ourselves that there's really no distance between myself and God. Because the human ego constantly wants to affirm separateness. That's the subconscious self that we were talking about, the shudra self, the pleasure-seeking self, the self-centered self. It's always trying to affirm its distance. Whereas, as I was talking last week, we become a kshatriya, and we begin to understand that it's only an inner battle, that there's really no problems externally. It's entirely an inner battle. It's entirely a question of bringing ourselves into alignment with the ideals that we know to be true. And once we bring ourselves into alignment, those ideals are the reality. And everything external is quite incidental to that. It's just a question of bringing ourselves into alignment. This is the whole process of spiritual growth and spiritual development, is to bring that self into alignment. Paramhansa Yogananda said to Dr. Lewis, is the one he happened to say this to, but he said, Dr. Lewis, you must understand, you never forget, God loves you just as much as he loves Christ or Buddha or any great soul that ever lived. You know, he's our common father. Now, it's so easy in our own minds to imagine that God naturally loves Paramhansa Yogananda more than he loves me. Because after all, Paramhansa Yogananda is just a much better guy than I am, you know? He did his kriyas all the time. He never missed, you know? He had no other interests as opposed to the average Joe. So therefore, God being a lot like me is probably very conditional and measured in his love. And he would naturally love a saint more than he would love me. But that's not true. The difference between us and a saint is the fact that the saint knows that God loves him. And that absolute certainty of that divine relationship shifts everything about that saint's reality. You see? Because once you understand God's love for you, you also understand God's love for everyone. Once you receive God's love in your own heart, it's very easy to love everyone. You're just overflowing with it. Everything is always a projection of our own consciousness. We always see around us exactly what we are. And when we begin to see in our own selves this experience of God's love for us, then we just sort of see it everywhere, and we begin to put it out everywhere. But nothing has changed. Nothing has ever changed except the realization has changed. Now, there's something that happens, which I'm sure you've all experienced to a lesser or greater extent, because we all experience it. There's this strange phenomenon where we work so hard to progress on the spiritual path. We're always putting out effort. We're always trying. But when we suddenly find that our consciousness actually does shift, it never feels like it has anything to do with our own effort. It just feels like just suddenly things are different. And it's like they've always been different. And it's very difficult to connect your self-effort with that shift. And that's why the vocabulary people always use is the grace of God. It was just the grace of God that it happened. Because it was like I was just doing the same thing I was always doing, and then suddenly it got different. Now, you can trace it back logically and say, well, it's because of all the kriyas I did, and just in my meditation class last week, I put up the chakras and I showed what happens when you increase the energy of the spiritual eye and how the vrittis in the different chakras begin to dissolve, and I actually intended to do some of that a little bit tonight. I mean, all of that is true, so you can reason out that it had something to do with your own effort, but it doesn't feel like that. Partly it's because once you're centered in spirit, there is no effort. The effort is when you're centered in the ego. Because it's the ego, there's this tension created by ego. Because ego is this desperate attempt to remain little when absolutely everything in the universe is conspiring to make you infinite. I often think of it like a diving bell. And, you know, the enormous pressure of the ocean is just there wanting to permeate the diving bell and make it one with the sea. And so the diving bell has to be built with all this great force to just keep the pressure of the ocean at bay. Otherwise, the bell would just become, and everything in it would just become part of the ocean. Now, when you're thinking in terms of protecting human life, that's not a very happy image. But the fact of the matter is that the little ego exists in this great infinity of spirit, and the infinity of spirit is trying to love us back into itself. It's trying to get our attention and explain to us that we are actually one with the infinite, and all this stress and separation is just folly, And if we just accepted all that, we'd be so free. And then we're working so hard to just hold, you know, this picture of separation against the constancy of the divine force trying to love us back into itself. So when we finally let go of just even a little bit of that force, see, we think of it as pushing forward, but actually what it's doing, it's relaxing from. It's releasing the tension of separateness and accepting the fact of reality. And when, as soon as we let any holes come into our diving bell of ego, so to speak, the water begins to run in. We've all seen the submarine movies. We know what that's like, you know. And in the movies, it's always panic-stricken because the water comes in wherever it can. So whenever we relax our ego, even a little bit, the water of divine grace starts pouring in. And by very definition, that does not feel like an effort. Because what you've done is you've stopped affirming separateness and accepted the reality that was always there. You see? I mean, all of these are just words, but that's the actual experience we have, isn't it? There's just a point at which we let go. And coming back to John's specific question, you know, by the grace of... I can't even remember what the words are. Somebody help me. What are the words? By the grace of our masters, you are free. It's what we want to affirm is that as a fact. We don't want to affirm that we're still participating in it. It's just the opposite. It's surrendering to that by the grace of the masters. You know, because God's grace is always there, because you are a disciple, because the master has promised to liberate you, you're free. You're just, this is your reality. It is who you are right now. To emphasize, let the masters do this or something, brings the ego back into the story. It brings back that question of, I'm going to do it, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to try to do it, I may not try hard enough to do it. It brings the self into the equation at that point, when what you really want to do is you just want to make a statement, by the grace of the masters, you're free. By the power that the masters have. Because also it comes in the purification ceremony, there's the part that comes first, which is the master says, open first. The only part that the devotee does, and this is the only thing that the devotee says, for the few of you who haven't done this ceremony, you come forward and a light bearer, which is a person such as myself, appointed by Swamiji to carry on this ceremony, the devotee comes to that person and says, I seek purification by the grace of God. Now, even then, you see, you're saying two things. You're saying, this is my chosen path, but you're also saying, it's by the grace of God that I'm looking for this. That has two meanings, that by the grace of God, I have enough sense to look. And the other side of it is that I know that it's the grace of God that's going to cure me, not my own egoic effort. And then the very fact the word is purification, I seek purification. Purification is also itself a magnificent word, and it's very different than confession. Because purification is that you're pure in yourself. It's just that you have to get rid of a few of these little things that are kind of clouding the picture. I just want to purify. I'm pure metal, and I just need to be a little fired up a little, and it'll all come clean. And we've been out playing in the mud. I'm not really saying that properly. But, you know, we've taken the pure self, we've sullied it up, and now we have to clean it up again. But it's never really shifted. It's always a diamond, no matter how deeply buried it is and whatever it's buried in. When you see these treasure hunters who go to the bottom of the ocean and they pull up the Spanish doubloons or whatever they're pulling up, they go way down in there. It's been down there for centuries. They pull it out of all that silt, and when they clean it off, it's pure gold. Nothing has ever touched it. It's just been covered over with silt. So when we bring ourselves, what I seek is that the gold of my own nature be revealed by the grace of God, that I become purified. I release those things that don't belong to me. This is what Jesus says in his Sermon on the Mount. In Beatitudes, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. There's also a subtle word there, that purity of heart is to cleanse the heart of all small-minded egoic thinking. The meannesses of the heart, that's the word I'm looking for. Jealousy, you know, greed, anxiety, self-concern. You purify yourself of those things. And what's left is the goodness of your own nature. You don't have to create the goodness. You just have to release that which is not really you. That's what you're asking for. I want the grace of God to come into me, because when the grace of God comes into me, then all of a sudden I realize who I am. Isn't that what happens to us? We're depressed, we're worried, we're anxious, and then, I don't know, something happens. One of the eight manifestations of spirit comes into our reality. Love, peace, joy, wisdom, the sound of Om, the light of the, in meditation, the wisdom to understand our own nature. One of the eight manifestations comes into us, and all of a sudden, our consciousness shifts, and we just know that everything is different, don't we? Isn't that so? Nothing changes except our perception. I seek purification by the grace of God. I want to be purified by the inflow of spirit. Then the light bearer says back, the master says, open your heart to me, and I will enter and take charge of your life. That's such a remarkable phrase, isn't it? It just says, work with me. You know, let me into the story. But then it also, it says, you know, we're surrendering. We're putting our hands into God's hands. Where is it in? I can't remember what the first words were, but what Master said to one of his disciples, Dr. Lewis or Rajasi, he asked him some question like, you know, will you always love me or something like that? And then when the disciple said yes, Master said, good, you know, now we can get to work like that. That's the part of it that was so charming. Master rubs his hands together, you know, now good, we're going to free you from your ego and bring you to God. Master was like gleeful about it, because you're going to cooperate with me. So that's what we're doing in the purification. We're saying, okay, Lord, I want to cooperate with you. I'm tired of doing it my own way. I mean, been there, done that, old story, not interested. I want to become the pure gold of my nature by allowing you. Then the light bearer says, right, okay. Master says, open your heart to me, and I'll take charge. So it's that surrender, too, to letting the guru work through you. And then, after the blessing, coming all the way back to John's question, then we have to say, by the grace of God, you're free. You've sought purification, you've humbled yourself, you've opened yourself, you've responded to the Master's thought, so now it's a fact. If we then go back to self-effort, you know, let it happen, which John was trying to affirm as a positive thought, and I understand why, but you see, it subtly brings it back to egoic effort. It's so, attunement is everything. It's all about attunement. We think it's about self-effort, but the self-effort required is for attunement, which is to really understand, what do I know? It's just like, what do I know? Why am I always insisting on my own point of view? I've talked about this in this room on these night classes many different times before, but I know for some of you I'm reiterating, but so many of us, and I'm using Swami as the example because he's the embodiment, of Master's presence in our lives. He's the advanced disciple who has been given responsibility for communicating Master's will to us. And over many, many years, many of us who work with Swami a lot, and in fact, all of Ananda, it just becomes defined by his reality, even in very small ways. I was complimenting Pam's beautiful blue sweater here. Immediately, I think to myself, you know, whenever Swamiji's around, we always wear beautiful colors because he likes beautiful colors. And even when I shop for clothes, I'll think, oh, this is classy. This is a classy brown shirt. You know, it looks really elegant. But I'll think, I could never wear this around Swami. He wouldn't want to see brown. And so I'll think, well, why would I buy this? Because if Swami wouldn't like seeing it, why would I wear it anywhere? Then, you know, sometimes I buy it. But invariably, if it doesn't conform to the reality that he has presented, even in very small ways, that may seem just kind of fatuous, but it's not. It's just the mind always turning. Why should I do it my way? Why not just do it in the flow? And that's why Master had, you know, had opinions about even very small things. Swami tells it in the path. He said something to Master about, he had some ideas for developing a garden at Mount Washington, and Master said, you know, he mentioned one of the other disciples, I think it was Ananda Mata. Speak to Ananda Mata about it. She knows my will for the garden. And Swami is honest enough in the path when he presents that statement that part of him said, can't I have my own ideas about anything? You know? But in fact, why would we want to? You know, because the picture that we're trying to make, and Swamiji says this about himself now. He said after he finished, he said it after he finished writing The Essence of Self-Realization, which was the first book after The Path, in which he communicated to us the ideas that he'd learned from Master. And he wrote that book in the little house that's now the guest house of the Crystal Hermitage, which was actually the house that David and I built and lived in briefly. It may even have been, I'm not sure whether we had moved out already and he was in that house or we had given him the house and gone somewhere else, I don't recall. But he was in that house when he wrote it, and the power went out because there was a big snowstorm, and he was in that house without electricity, so he couldn't use his computer. He had to write with a pencil, which actually, he said, turned out to be a real blessing because he had a lot of notes from his years with Master when he wrote that book, but there were also, because it was a theme-related book, sometimes he needed to fill things out a little bit because he needed a whole chapter on a certain subject. And if he didn't have notes, he would pray to Master to be able to remember other things that Master said. And he said he would hear Master's voice in his head. He has spoken in other places about the grace he had of being able to really remember, you know, really, I don't know if there's any limit to what he can remember of what Master said. He hears Master's voice in his mind. It's not like Master's talking, but Swami hears it as he heard it. You know, the memory is vivid. It's a superconscious memory. So Master would, he would remember what Master said, and then he'd write it down. And then sometimes he would say to Master, "You have to talk a little slower. I'm having to write this by hand." And then he would get it all. And so he said, because he didn't have electricity, he wrote very, very sensitively because he was just sitting in complete quiet in such a way. After that, Swamiji made the comment that he really can't tell anymore what thoughts are his and what thoughts are Master's. You know, just that his whole consciousness has become so surrendered to his guru that the ideas that come into his head, he doesn't know where they're coming from. Now, that's an important aspect to remember with thoughts are not individual but universal. We merely reflect states of consciousness. We do not create them. So since we are simply reflecting states of consciousness, I mean, we're so proud of our own ideas, but we're just picking them up from whatever strata, vibrational strata we happen to be on. Do you understand that? There's no you. You know, there is the superconscious and the subconscious, and the conscious is the battleground in the middle. And we are just picking up either our own old habits or new ideas from the superconscious, and even what level of the superconscious is it coming from. There is no reality to what we call ourself. The ego is an arbitrary line drawn around a field of consciousness that we have then staked out as our own turf. But even that is just stratas of awareness drifting through. So the simple question is, what strata of awareness do you want to have drift through? And if we have lived a conscientious life, as Swami Kriyananda has certainly lived, of offering every thought to Master, and saying, "What would you have me do?" If we do that long enough, then the habit of saying, "Well, what do I want?" just simply goes away. And it becomes just simply, "What do you want, Master?" And we become automatically in tune with that flow. That comes when we purify the heart. The heart is the place of likes and dislikes, where we say, "I want to do this, I don't want to do that, but I like brown, I think brown is elegant." Or we say, "Swami doesn't, so, you know, so what do I care if I like it? He doesn't. And what do I care if I want to do this or that? It's not what Master recommended. Why would I still want to do it? Open your heart to me and I'll take charge of your life." Now, how conscientiously we do that just depends. Then we become a magnet for the guru's thoughts or for the thoughts of whatever random level of consciousness we're accustomed to living on. And Swamiji has just merged his consciousness with Master's by conscientiously, consistently, in every situation, asking the question, "What would Master do?" And not "What did Master do?" but "What would he do now?" Swami makes an important point. It's an active thought. What would he do now? How would he respond And I know it's sort of a joke, what would Jesus do? But it's a very, very, very profound and wonderful spiritual practice, especially when it's acted out intelligently with attunement and not dogmatically looking backwards, but dynamically in the present moment. If we've really turned our life over to Master, then what would he do? What does he want to have happen right now? And it takes time to learn that, and we can become a little bit self-deluded in that process. That's why Swamiji's example is such an important one, both because he makes Master's wishes concrete to us and because his example of how a disciple lives. You see, because Swamiji is extraordinarily creative and he's not at all rigidly loyal to what Master did. When Swamiji created, for example, the Festival of Light, there were people who said, well, Master never did anything like that. No, Master never did anything like that, but maybe Master wants it done now. And I mean, that was Swami's deeply, sincerely felt feeling. It's not more in tune to demand that we do everything the way he did then, because if there was any characteristic of the guru, it's that he's utterly creatively responsive in the moment. That's why you have to endeavor to be in tune with him. That's the difference between just knowing what he said and actually being in tune with him. Because Master himself was unpredictable. He wasn't consistent, in any way consistent. He just responded according to what was necessary at the time. Swami writes this in The Path also. True teaching is individual. Someone he'll teach to do one thing, and the other he'll teach to do exactly the opposite. Because it just depends on where they are in relation to the center and what's forward for them. Remember the four castes I put up at the beginning? How do you tell what's forward for you? Well, it depends on where you're standing, that's all. And quite literally, what's forward for one person could be backward for another. I remember a very specific incident with Swamiji when this one woman was just working all the time and her friend in front of her said to Swami, don't you think she should take a day off? And Swami looked very stern. He says, I know what's good for her. Just like that. You let me decide. I know what's good for her. In fact, the woman, she couldn't handle time off. Anytime she had time off, she got very moody and self-concerned. You know, what was saving her was all of her selfless service because it was keeping her mind off herself. It was transforming her consciousness. And working like that was exactly the right thing for her. Give her a little time to herself and she would become all morose and upset, but just keep her busy giving to others. And it was purifying her heart. You know, but for another person, I mean, quite literally, Swami would say, just don't do so much. Because he saw it as a manifestation of restlessness. And, you know, you need to just have a little quiet time. Set aside a day a week for long meditation. Spend more time in the morning just reading spiritual books. Take long walks. You just never know what he's going to say specifically to someone. It just depends on what's so. So you have to be in tune in order to find that. Which brings us back to what the original question was. You know, by the grace of God, we're free. And that's how we want to think of it. Just by the grace of God, I'm free. Instead of thinking, oh, if I just work a little harder, I'll be free. No, no, no. By the grace of God, I am free. Just repeat that and contemplate that. And think what use your creative imagination to project yourself into that, not as an affirmation, but as a fact. Live that way. How would you live? If you're free, how are you living? Are you living free, or are we living always anxious, always concerned, never feeling like we're doing enough? It's just a little tiny thought. Swamiji tells us the story of when this man was dying in the hospital, and Swami went to visit him, and the man was sort of in his, you know, anxiety as he approached death. Oh, he kept saying, I've done so many bad things in my life. And when Master heard about it, Master got very sad. He said at this time in his life, he should be affirming all the goodness. You know, he could so easily have said, oh, I've lived a wonderful life. I've just been such a privilege to be alive. And you see, that then that thought is your orientation. And death is just the final exam. But on an everyday basis, very interesting, watch what the first thought is that comes into your mind when you wake up in the morning. Is it one of, oh, just glory to be here again? Or is it immediately anxiety about something? by the grace of God, you are free. So where is that thought in our consciousness? Does that make sense to everyone? I mean, this is exactly what I wanted to talk about tonight, which is why I asked John to remind me with this question. Because here we are at the end, personal and planetary evolution, and what we're really talking about now is like, what do we really do with all this information? Are there any questions on anything I just said first before I go on with this? Any thoughts? Are you satisfied with that answer? Okay. I'm glad you reminded me of the question. John asked me a long time ago, and I forgetting to answer. The first part of the class that we talked about was the evolution of the ego, yugas, the turning of the age. I think that that's an extraordinarily useful thing to think about, because it's very easy to become very anxious about the state of the world. And we also have to realize in this whole picture, you know, thinking in terms of reincarnation, friends, how many times have we sat here and been concerned about the state of the world? You know, were we wiped out by ash in Pompeii? Did we die on the battlefield in the Second World War or in Vietnam? Were we gassed in the Holocaust? Did we die in the Civil War? You know, did we go down with the Roman Empire? Did we die in the Titanic? You know, just like, you can go back and back, and there's all these, every so often, they'll quote some paragraph about what a mess the times are, and then they'll tell you that it was written in 10 BC or something like that. It's just like, there's just been this, because the human ego is always anxious. And even in higher ages, the human ego is anxious. I recall a conversation with Swamiji in which I think I said this to you perhaps at that class earlier, where he was talking about, at that point he was saying he just really does never want to come back. He said, even in the higher ages, I don't want to be here. Because it's still the material plane. You're still bound by a physical body. You're still bound by an ego. Everybody's still acting from various levels of egoic consciousness. In higher ages, it's not as gross as it is now. I mean, for the first 15 years of my spiritual life, I lived up at Ananda Village, this rural ashram. We were, especially the first 10 years, we were so isolated. It was just our people, and then people who would come in. Life was, we were broke, and physical conditions were a little primitive, but I don't know, that never bothered me at all. It was absolutely heavenly. It was just like being in heaven on earth. We were just surrounded with wonderful people. Swamiji was there. We were doing good work. I mean, I just can't imagine life on the physical plane being any better. That's pretty much what Satya Yuga is a lot like. You know, it's just, it's happier. The whole world is like Ananda, is how Swamiji put it. You know, everybody understand. It's a higher age. But still, you know, your friends, things happen to everyone. It's not fully satisfying. So part of what the yugas help us understand, number one, they help us understand that in the present moment, there is reason behind the madness that you see around you. This is a transition age, and transitions are between the yugas are always extremely chaotic. And it simply isn't going to resolve quickly or easily, because we have two extremely different forces pulling at each other. And in fact, there will probably be catastrophic consequences from those forces. The way Swamiji describes it, he said usually in normal times, the distribution of good and evil is like a fat cigar. And there's a few really good people on the planet and a few really bad ones, and everybody else just hangs out in the kind of fat, soggy middle right here. He said in transition times, things polarize and the middle gets very skinny, and the evil, it gets more like a dumbbell. And the evil end gets stronger, and the good end gets stronger, and it's harder to just sort of hang out in the middle. Right now, you can still hang out in the middle, but things are still, they're polarizing. So there's no way that we, with our little human consciousness, can say, we can stop this change, we can convert these people, we can make it like this, you know. People just get so utterly egocentric, as if it really was just a question of let's all vote to have a better world. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. In the monthly newsletter that you'll be getting soon, I make some reference to the fact that I've actually been interested in this presidential campaign. I'm losing interest, but I was interested. I've registered to vote, which it's all very unusual for me to do these things, because I usually just look at the political world and think, I'm just not qualified to evaluate it. I don't really know any of these people, and I don't know anything about the system, and I'm just not, it's not my planet. I just generally never think of this as really my planet. It's just the place where we live. You know, it just doesn't have anything to do with us, meaning what I call the nation of self-realization. It's just everybody else's business. But this one seems a little more interesting. But on the other side of it, it's like, it's just going to come and go. What was I going to say about this? Oh, yes. These people are all instruments of a greater destiny. They're not making the destiny. They're acting out the destiny that's determined. Do you see the difference? It isn't really going to be decided, like the fate of the world will not really depend on whether the Democrat or the Republican gets elected. The Democrat or Republican will get elected depending on the fate of the world. It's like it's like this huge karmic forces are happening and individuals step into the stream. Individuals do not create that stream. Now, as individual people, we create our own destiny where we're going to fit into that experience. That, you see, is what we have the mastery over. Do you see the difference? We have mastery over what our consciousness will be while those things happen. And then, to a certain extent, we will determine what we're going to attract or not attract. You know, where we'll be at the right time. There's so many stories of divine protection when the consciousness is there. And death itself sometimes is a protection. You know, it's not a bad thing to die. But if it's not, if your karma, if you have worked to be in tune with the spirit, then you will always be exactly where you're supposed to be. You won't ever get caught up in the group karma. It's a very interesting thing Master said. If for example, there's a whole plane load of people and they all die, you know, the plane crashes and they all die, he says it was not necessarily everyone's karma to die. But some people may have not had strong enough karma to live to break out of the mass karma. You see? That they were right on the edge, and so they got swept up into it because the habit of their lives was not to generate enough specific magnetism for their own destiny. If you're doing Kriya Yoga, if you're devoted to God, if you're praying, if you're constantly asking yourself, what does God want me to do? What does the Guru want me to do? Then you're participating in your own evolution. You're not just sort of floating along, letting things happen. Swami famously calls it to me the rock in the river. You put a rock in the river. You say, I will be in charge of my own consciousness. I'm just not going to float along. And then your destiny is your own destiny. You don't just get caught up in things. There's a story that comes to mind. I don't even know the details of it, but a man was he was a lawyer, and he was giving an oration in a courtroom, and suddenly he was affected with such a tickle in his throat, he just began to cough and cough. Finally, he had to excuse himself and leave the courtroom, and he was on the street, and he was coughing like that, and a landslide came and obliterated the building behind him. But he had the destiny not to die there, so he walked out of the room. He wasn't there. Isn't that strange? Here's another, just a different one. Edgar Casey, who was a very, you know, great psychic and sensitive, there's a story told of him. He was in a building somewhere, and an elevator door opened, and he just started to step into the elevator because it was going the direction he wanted, but something compelled him to step back. The doors closed, and the cable broke, and all those people fell and were killed. And he realized, you know, just a few seconds after the doors closed, that no one in the elevator had an aura, and that he instinctively saw that they had no auras, and it just looked so odd to him that he stepped back. He didn't think they're about to die. He just saw that everything about that elevator was wrong, because this is some very comforting thing. When people die in sudden violent deaths, the soul withdraws just before the moment of impact, which people tell you often. When they live through these things, they'll tell you that just before the cars collided, I was suddenly floating above. Because the soul says, out of here, you know. This one is finished, and I'm just not going to hang around for it. And so those people were seconds away from their death. And so their souls had already, their field of energy had already withdrawn. The bodies were already virtually uninhabited. And that's what he saw. So he just didn't, he stepped back from it instinctively. Isn't that amazing? And part of that just causes you to say, Why do I ever worry about anything? There was a movie that I saw that I don't remember even what the movie was, but there was one moment in it that was so vivid to me. It was about American Indians, and it was one of those, you know, toward the end, one of those horrible sagas where the last brave remnant is being hunted by the cruel white people through the winter, and through, it was just, you know, it just went on and on and on. But one of the themes was one of the noble Indians, because it was really written to glorify the Native Americans. He was a very noble leader, and one of the themes of the movies was every so often he would have this sort of ephemeral vision of some island in the middle of a river. And he'd had it all his life. Every so often he would see this thing. And then at the very end of this movie, when you know you can see that everybody's going to get wiped out, they turn a corner, and all of a sudden in real life, he sees the river and he sees the island. He's looking at what he'd been had vision of for, you know, for so many years of his life, and he intuitively realizes that that's the place where that's his death spot. He's going to die on that island. His response was remarkable. He becomes very sad. He says, "Oh, if I had only known," he said, "what a brave warrior I would have been." Meaning that as long as I wasn't seeing that island, I wasn't going to die, so what did I have to fear? I would have been so courageous if I had known that this was my death place, and if I wasn't there, I was going to live. But I've always thought of that. You know, it's really, it's going to happen, whatever is going to happen anyway. Our fate is in God's hands. Now, the other side of it is, from the point of view of personal evolution, that is the whole point of personal evolution. That's what personal evolution is. It's not that the ego becomes more and more masterful. It's not that we become more and more capable, you know, of earning $1 million and doing this and doing that. Yes, those are sort of side effects. But they're side effects of intuition, of clarity of mind, of fearlessness, of energy, of wisdom, of love, of joy. You know, just all those things, the side effects are we can move through this world much more effectively. But they're side effects of inner awareness. And inner awareness is really the prize that we're seeking. But one of the ways we practice and prove it and hone it is by using it. Because just to say, "Oh, I used to work, but now I'm just enlightened," you know, is probably going to be pretty fatuous. Because those who are really enlightened tend to work all the harder and all the more. Because part of our salvation, part of the way the world works, is simply that to give is the nature of the divine. I mean, think about it. God is giving to us all the time. He's giving sunlight, air, water, energy, light, inspiration, love, constantly. And one of the principles of the, well, every week in the Festival of Light, we have that we describe the masters. We say, "Greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world." So what we're talking about is a self-realized master with no karma of his own, willingly, essentially steps back into prison. When people, the best image I've come up with after years of trying to think about this, about what it is that a master does, it's like we're all incarcerated, you know, deep in the heart of Folsom Prison for our actual crimes. You know, everybody in prison is innocent, but we're not innocent. We really did it. We identified with the ego. We desired the things that can only be experienced through the material body. We had enormous unlearned lessons on the material plane, so we're imprisoned in the material plane in the sense that we cannot extricate ourselves from it by our own free will, because our karma has locked us here. All the energy in the chakras is directed toward holding on to the material plane, and we can't just say, "Oh, I think I'll just ascend." We can kill the physical body by an act of suicide, but that doesn't liberate our consciousness. That just causes us to die and then just be the same and then have the extra bad karma of having killed ourselves. It just doesn't take us anywhere. A master transcends it. You see, it's an entirely different thing. He's not bound. There's no karma there. There's no attachment. There's no misunderstanding. But a master decides, "Oh, those poor saps in prison, they haven't the foggiest idea, you know, where the key is or how to saw through the bars. I'll go back. And then he goes back and he wears the prison uniform and he eats the crummy prison food and he does all that stuff. And just like us, except the difference is that he didn't have to be there, and he could have walked out at any time, but he wants to be there with us because somebody's got to help those poor saps in prison. Greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. Then comes the line, here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey through time and space. And they're connected because that absolute willingness to consider the welfare of others the same as your own welfare, to willingly just do whatever is needful for the salvation of others, is the state that the soul must reach. All souls, that's what freedom is. There's no self, there's just giving. We become one with God. That's the nature of God, is endless, unconditional. That's the bliss of the Spirit. It's constantly pouring out on us. This is back to that point. This is our reality. We are constantly being drenched in this divine love. It's our own nature. We're just desperately holding it at bay with all these thoughts of anxiety and unworthiness and this and this and this and this and this, and I will get to it someday, but not today. Right? And meanwhile, it's not like it ever changes. That's why Master said it's so amazing to contemplate. Here we are, on this planet. We get so tired and we get arthritis and we get old and we get desperately disappointed and our children just don't come out right and, nothing really happens the way it's supposed to. And it's just we've worked so hard. I mean, I've been working on the school play and, there's these darling little children, some of them. they're just so cute. One little child, one of my friends who was helping me said, he's such an advertisement for motherhood, because he's just like his parents must have got him out of a catalog. Perfect child. Assemble yourself like your own computer. Just perfect child. There he is. He's all put together. But my father said it to me so poignantly. He said, all of those little children, they disappear into the adult, was the word he used. They just disappear. And how many adults are darling? Not very many. We get sort of pudgy and a little warty as we get older. It's just like we just get really different. And we just do it over and over. What was I saying about that? And at the same time, we just, I know what I was going to say. There's a stage on the spiritual path where you have this intense desire to sort of have somebody explain to you why the system is the way it is. And the answer that the masters always give, which is very unsatisfactory at a certain state in your own mind, is simply that no one who's ever achieved God realization has thought it was unfair. Because it's like it never was there. You can't complain about something that was never there. Just because you imagine that something was there and you imagine that somebody... you're really upset about this cloud. This cloud has formed itself into this ugly shape. And then you get up to it and you realize that there's no ugly shape and there was not even a cloud. It was just the angle that you were looking at it. You can't sort of remain furious at the cloud. It just doesn't make any sense at that point because you realize it was never there. And so all this suffering that we impose upon ourselves because of the impurity of our heart, so that we don't see God. We just see our own limited reflection coming back to us. But when we finally get that out of the way and we actually see what is, we realize nobody ever did anything to us because there was no self to have anything done to. And there's just no way to be crabby about it because there's nothing to be crabby about. It's just bliss. And the other part of that is that it's not an all or nothing proposition. That's why Swamiji in the Festival of Light picked up from the Bhagavad Gita that line, even a little practice of this inward religion will free one from dire fears and colossal sufferings. When Swamiji wrote the festival, he just picked pieces out of, you know, the Jewish prayers, a little bit out of Christianity, some of the classic Hindu statements. I remember this woman, she was an Israeli, and sometimes Israelis are extremely intense about their identity, because, of course, their identity is always under siege. So she was one of those, and she approached me. I can't even remember what it was in the Festival of Light, but there's something in the Festival of Light that she found slightly offensive toward Judaism. I mean, she picked a good girl to ask because of my Jewish background, so it was. I'm used to that. She didn't know it. I can't remember exactly what she was even talking about, but I said, oh, you don't understand. The festival contradicts Christianity all over the place, too. It's like he's not just being rude to traditional Judaism. He's being rude to the Christians, too. He's just equal in his, you know, here, for example, the Christ consciousness. You know, the Christ consciousness ascending, the only Christ. I can't remember what the exact words are right now, but the only begotten Son, that's the phrase. I quoted from her a couple of the Christian phrases that Swami reinterprets through the festival, just throws out centuries of dogmatism and just gives it an entirely new meaning. And she sort of said, oh, you know, it's like it's a new thing altogether that we're doing. We're just saying it completely differently. We're going at it completely differently. And when we, in our own hearts, just really accept that. That's the whole goal. That's what personal evolution is about. Then live, die, fame, lack of fame. And there's nothing stopping us. We don't have to wait for a higher yuga. It won't even help to be in a higher yuga. The only thing that's stopping us is our lack of spiritual adventuresomeness. Oh, what I wanted to say about that, though, is a girlfriend of mine years ago, she was being extremely crabby, really, really crabby. And I was appointed to see if I could understand why she was being crabby, and especially if I could persuade her to be less crabby, because she was making life miserable for all of us. So in the course of conversation, she finally confessed to me that her meditations were going very badly. And, you know, and essentially what she was saying, therefore I'm justified in being so unpleasant all the time, because after all, I'm... you know, it is a real tragedy that my meditations are going badly, so my mood is justified. That was basically what she was saying. I said, ooh, when my meditations go badly, I feel that I have to be really nice all the time because it's the only thing I have going for me at that point. And it was the truth. I meant that. You know, it's like that's our obligation, is to be an instrument of divine consciousness at all times. There's no justification for not being so. And Master put it when he said, whenever you're in a mood, Satan has a hold of you. Whenever anything has persuaded you that now I'm justified to be out of bliss because of this, because of that, because I'm so worried about the world, because I'm upset about what's happening to my husband, because I'm so sick about this thing or that thing, because I'm so anxious about this, has God stopped loving you? Has bliss stopped being our nature? It's sometimes Haridas had an acronym. Haridas, many of you know, he's a longtime member of Ananda. And he was very clever. He had an acronym called SPIDOG, S-P-I-D-O-G, Solve Problems in Direction of God. That was how he put it. And what that meant was, whatever problem you have, try to resolve it by going closer to the light. Don't try to resolve it by psychological means, by distracting yourself, by self-justification. Just say, whatever it is, if I were more in the grace of God, I wouldn't be having this problem. Because the only reason this appears to be a problem to me, the only reason I'm upset because of the way she treated me, not only in this life, but in the past lives that I remember, and how really accurately she just always misunderstands me and she tells bad things to other people and then they don't like me. You know, the only reason you even feel that way is because something inside of you is not content and not thinking about, well, a person would only behave that way if they're unhappy in themselves. And what does it matter what other people think of me? It's just between me and God. All our insecurity. But when you feel inside your heart, God's presence inside our heart, as soon as you're lifted up like that, do we care does it matter to us what other people think? It's just, we just feel compassion. We feel perfectly calm. I am what I am before my conscience and God. You know, all problems are just solved by coming more into the light. The eight manifestations of God: love, joy, peace, wisdom, energy, calmness, divine light, sound. More of that automatically drives out everything else. Solve every problem in the direction of God. The more we just cut through all the details and just go right to that point and change consciousness. Swami writes this in The Path. He talks about when he got into this mood when he was a disciple, and he just had this really strong feeling that Master just didn't care for him. And he tells this story about how there was a bottle of water that had to be carried up to Master's upstairs room, and Swamiji commandeered the task for himself and carried the bottle up, and he really wanted Master to pay attention to him. And he went into the kitchen and he kind of clanged around with the bottle, and Master was in the other room doing some work, and Master just didn't even acknowledge his being there, didn't greet him, didn't stop anything he was doing. And so Swami decided, you know, not whatever he decided that, you know, Master was still a master, but the obvious problem was with Swami, that Master probably thought, oh, here comes that worthless disciple here, give me a letter to dictate so I don't have to talk to him. And this is what Swami's mind is doing. And then he thought, this is just crazy. And he left the bottle and he went downstairs to meditate. And he sat in meditation. His reason was just giving him every reason to feel terrible. But he sat in meditation and he raised his attention to the point between the eyebrows and he concentrated on the light. The light came into him and he just immediately, all of that just went away. Because he felt Master's love in his heart. And he thought, well, he's busy, of course. He can't stop every time anybody comes in. But also, what did it matter? He felt Master's love in his heart. That's why we talk so much about both devotion and meditation. Because with devotion, above all with devotion, it's very hard without devotion. Because with devotion, it's the feeling level. When the feeling is there, everything else follows. Reason follows feeling. And when the feeling is there, everything else follows. When the feeling is right, everything else follows from that. That's why Swamiji, in the workings of Ananda, he never really sweats the small stuff. Like some leaders are very anxious about every little detail. He's always anxious that the spirit and the energy be right. If the spirit and energy are right, he says almost any decision will be fine. If the spirit and energy are wrong, he says, really, whatever you do is going to come out badly no matter what. And so he's always watching for the feeling of things. Because if you're acting in the right feeling, even if you're a little stupid and misguided, which we sometimes are, you know, it won't matter because there'll be a positive magnetic flow. And even if you're exactly right about everything you're doing, but there's all this ego and not a supportive vibration for one another. That's why I told the story in Sunday service not too long ago. I put it in the book, where they were in India and there was a lot of pressure and a little bit of tension was building among people. I mean, people are people everywhere. And Swamiji called the entire staff together for a staff meeting, which is a big thing to get all the people in one room. And he said, he referred to some little exchange that had happened between people and somebody had been over frank with another person. And he said, well, maybe so-and-so really did need to have their faults pointed out to them, but it would have been better if it had been done without anger. And in that beautiful way, Swamiji affirmed both sides of the dispute. But then he said, if you do nothing else that I ask of you, I ask, do this one thing. He said, be kind to one another. That was it. And then he dismissed the staff. I mean, that was the entire meeting. He got them all together just to say that. It's amazing when you think about that. Be kind to one another. But think about what the internal consciousness is like that causes us to be unkind to a person. Just unkindness. It's a simple word. Why are we ever unkind? We're unkind when our self-concern is greater than our concern for someone else. You can tell people the truth. You can ask them to do things for you. You can correct them. If you do it with kindness, it's entirely different than when we're unkind. We're only unkind when self-concern has dominated our thinking. So it's such a simple thought, but if you do nothing else, be kind to one another. Really, what he's saying, if you do nothing else, at all times maintain mastery over your own consciousness. But God is always loving to us. That doesn't mean we don't learn things, but the love is always there. It's always kind what God is doing to us because he's always trying to help us. He didn't say be nice to each other either. He says be kind, be conscious in what you do. And that, if you just parse that apart and make that the simple rule of life, you'll just see how very, very different everything can be. And that's all that, you know, evolution, this whole big thing, and I never did put the chakras on the board, but, you know, we have all the caste system, we have the yugas happening, we have karma, we have reincarnation. It really just comes down to maintain, moment by moment, mastery over your consciousness, be an instrument of the divine in everything you do. And when you fall from that, just like when we practice Hong Sa, I'm always telling the beginning meditators, you're watching the breath, you're saying the mantra, and when your mind wanders, find the breath, resume the mantra, and go back. That's all. You don't go through some big, oh my God, my mind has wandered again. Here we are. You know, you just find the breath and go back. Same thing with, oh, I lost my center. I behaved abominably. I murdered 16 people, and now I have to die in prison. But then you just bring it back, and you just go on from there. You don't, again, lament and create a big, I mean, bad enough that we behave badly, then we create a whole nother story. See, it's a double story, then that's why they call it a complex. Not only have I behaved badly, but now I have created a huge sense of despair and guilt and worthlessness and hopelessness and God doesn't love me because I behaved badly. So behaving badly really ceases to be the issue at all. The issue has become the huge egoic structure you've built on top of that. Everybody behaves badly. Just forget it and go on. In my book about Swamiji, I have that story where that woman did something really stupid, and days later she was still in a mood. Swami said, why are you like this? Oh, I just did this. It was so bad. He said, what egoism? She said, egoism? I'm feeling terrible. He said, because you're just so shocked that you could do something wrong that days later you're still thinking about it. I mean, think about that. I mean, just, we do something wrong. Why should it be such a cause for such an intense period of despair? It's like, welcome to the planet Earth. Just like, okay, you made a mistake. Let's not compound it. It's not easy. You say you have to, that's why Master says give it to God. That's why Swami says Master is pleased when we bring our successes, but more pleased when we bring our failures. Because it's really harder to relinquish our failures. We have more investment in our failures a lot of the time. And to be able to give those up is a sign of release. Now, are there any questions about what I've been talking about here? And then I'll go back to Sherry's question. Sherry's question was a simple one, so I'll just repeat it. She just asked me, why doesn't Swami like brown? When Swami described himself as a child, he talked about even in this world, he always lived more in another world of beautiful colors and lights. And he talks about how in his childhood, he used to gaze into the prism edge of the mirror of his mother's dressing table, and he would see all those lights and colors, and he would imagine himself being in that world. And he talks about ice skating and gazing into the ice. And he was really talking about the astral world, he was much more in the astral world. And then he talks about as a child, taking a colorful blanket and putting it over the table and then sitting underneath it and then the light through that colorful blanket again. He was really describing he was in really exalted superconscious states as a child, and he was just living that world, as he puts it in his own autobiography, was much more real to him than this one. This world was just sort of an odd, and he said, my earliest memory is wonder that I was in this world at all. You know, just like, what am I doing here? And he more or less stayed that way till he was 9. And then he really felt, well, I am here and I have to relate to it. So he started trying to relate to it, and he became miserable for all those years until he met his guru. But his body became unwell too. I think it was like the karma began to, the reality of this life kicked in. But he's always, you know, in the astral world, in the higher astral worlds, everything is luminous light and color. Clear, bright colors are the qualities of pure, bright consciousness. And it's not that brown is a terrible color. I mean, some of you are wearing it. It's not so bad in here tonight. Sometimes people, this whole room is filled with people who are all dressed in black. I mean, the quality of color, it has a healing power to it. It has vibrations of energy to it. It has uplifting reminders to it. You know, and so the habit, which is very rampant in our society, which I think is indicative of our culture, is that people just wear black. You know, really, like, what is it that we want to always be in that color instead of clear, bright colors? And clear, bright colors uplift your own consciousness. I mean, that color, both of you that I'm looking at, I mean, they're such lovely, bright shades. I have to have a little preference for the blue, just personally. But, you know, it's just, it has a wonderful vibration. If we were having a meditation seminar and, you know, we were projecting colors on a board with light, which we sometimes do, you know, we wouldn't put black up there. Okay, everybody now just concentrate on the black. You wouldn't even imagine doing it. We'd put blue up there. We'd put, you know, magenta. We'd put yellow. Because automatically, if you're projecting a big wall of colored light, that's the light you'd want to go into. You wouldn't want to go into black light. It's just the same when you're wearing it. I mean, I know it's a dilemma for Ananda women a lot because, you know, you want to have a pair of black pants and black shoes, just, you know, the sheer just difficulty of your wardrobe. So let's not be fanatical. But on the other hand, I certainly see it in myself. I walk into my closet and, you know, I'll look, yeah, take off your shawl. It's all right, Betty, it's just fine. Yeah, you're colorful underneath. But you know, I walk into my closet in the morning, and I'm particularly sensitive to this, but I'll walk into my closet and I'll watch myself. I'll watch myself want to go into sort of duller shades. Yeah, and I'll know why I want to do that. And because I'm so often in a position, there's not many times in my life where I have the freedom to not put out energy just because of the role I play. You know, I'm just always having to put out energy and always having to help move energy, which is, I consider to be a great blessing. And, you know, when I don't want to do it, I'll get up and I'll want to dress in dark brown, of which I have a little bit in my closet, and I'll just want to wear dark brown because I want to wear dark brown because, you know, I don't want to do it. Let's just, like, nobody ask anything of me today. I'm just going to be part of the woodwork today. And on the occasions when I can, I will. Because sometimes it's comforting. But I just see the dynamic right within me just getting dressed. And, I'll, you know, you put on something light and bright and it has a certain responsibility with it. And so when Swamiji's looking at us, I mean, it's partly he himself really does like color, but in the other, he doesn't like to see us dulling our consciousness or dulling our auras down. He wants to see us. It's partly just a charming personality characteristic. But I think it's a little more than that. In India, where you can get things made so easily, oftentimes the groups, when you travel with them in India, you'll end up in some tailor shop, and there's all those beautiful raw silks, and you'll end up with this whole crowd of people, and everybody just looks like a rainbow. You know, the men are all wearing these silk shirts, and it's really quite fun. And you don't normally do that, but it picks everybody's energy up. I mean, these are small things, but they're not small. Nothing is small. I mean, like, what is small? At what point is it okay to let the subconscious win? The battle of Kurukshetra, that's what you're always fighting. You're always fighting the battle of Kurukshetra. The conscious mind is the battleground between the superconscious and the subconscious. Swami himself wears blue most of the time, except when he wears... No, that's not true. He wears his Indian shirts. He wears the most outrageously wild-colored Indian shirts, meaning the silk shirts he had tailored in India. He'll just go pick out, he just has, you know, dozens of them because people give them to him, and he just drinks in the colors. His closet's just like a dream, and then he goes to India and wears nothing but orange. But when he leaves India, he goes into all his silk shirts, or else he'll wear blue because the vibration of it is right. Well, that seems like an odd place to end a four-week class. Do we have anything else to ask about? But not really. Fight the battle of life right where you're standing. Ramani?
It's not a question. It was just, we were doing light with those little kids you were working with.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with black is that there is no light.
There is no light.
I mean, with the pigment of black, it holds everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you have nothing coming back at you.
Right. Yeah. There you have it. And why would we want to do that? And the fact that our society is so tuned to black, I mean, it's, you know, it saved me a lot of money over the years because I just walk in a store and out of it again for all those years when everything was black. You know, the entire women's store would just be black. And I mean, just standing back objectively, I would, and women are, you know, historically they're the custodians of the moral fiber of a country, of a culture, and I just think, it's nothing but black in this store. What does this say about the attitude and the heart of women? Indian women think we're just crazy. You know, you go to India, and even the poorest women are dressed in brilliant colors. And even the women will say, like, who cares if the color looks nice on you? You wear it for the color. You're not wearing it for yourself. You just wear it because it's beautiful. And they have such a joyful attitude toward that. It's so refreshing. They just cannot understand American women's attitude. But it's one of those many things, and I guess I will answer it a little seriously. It's sort of silly. I often talk about fashion and clothes because it's one of my great weaknesses in life. I said to David, finally, look, let's just face it. At the end of this life, I will have spent more money on clothes than I absolutely had to. It's just the way it's going to be, you know. And I'm not really compulsive. I go to consignment stores mostly. I just like to change my clothes. I'm a Gemini. But it's often in the small things, this is what I'm going to say. When you look at the whole picture, often it seems overwhelming. And again, one of the things that Swami said to me once was, you have to practice when it's easier. And oftentimes we use as an excuse for inaction the thought that the whole project is too big. The whole project is too big, therefore I can't do anything because after all, the whole project is so big. And then we get to go into one of these, oh, I'm just overwhelmed, I can't really do anything. But the fact of the matter is we can always do something. And when we finally decide that we're really serious, we will do something. And really, it's the small actions that add up because you can't just go from standing here to way over there. You get there just, you know, like an inch at a time. And those little actions are really, it's just putting on the blue shirt or saying hello in a really friendly way or just putting in 5 minutes of meditation or whatever it is. It's all those little tiny actions that really are the making or the breaking of you. There's a certain point where the spiritual path is not about glamour. It's not about big gestures. It's not about huge, wonderful breakthroughs. It's just getting up in the morning and really just doing your best through that little day. And then my husband David is so good at this. You know, he's very little interested. I shouldn't embarrass him, but I've started now. He's very little interested in astrological readings or anything like that. I mean, his response usually is, what difference does it make? I'm just going to get up in the morning and I'm going to do my best all day. What do I need to know? What more do I need to know? Is basically the question. Who cares what or why the obstacles are there or what they are or when they'll lift or where they're coming from? I'm going to get up and I'm going to do my best every morning when I get up. It's not going to be better or worse because I had a reading yesterday or tomorrow. And it's just such a simple way to look at it. Every step of the day, we try to be in tune with Master. We try to reflect that light out to others. We try to just, on the little tiny little portion of consciousness we're giving, we try to be on the upper edge of it. You know, just be on the upper edge of it. I mean, it might not be great, but we'll just be on the upper edge of it. So simple. That's really all there is to it. Swami Master says, take care of the minutes. The incarnations will take care of themselves. I've quoted that to you so many times over the years. You must have heard it a million times from me alone. But it's a brilliant statement. And if you just make that the watchword of your life, what am I doing in this minute? And what can I do to make it better? Not what can I do to make this minute perfect, but what can I do to make it better? Given the fact that, you know, I'm crabby and I'm not really going to be perfect, I'm just going to be a little better. I can't tell you how radical that is. Just be a little better. Just be a little better each time. Practice when it's easier, just being a little better. And the whole project becomes, number one, doable, and number two, gradually becomes a success. Not instantly, but the change is total when it comes. Because every increment is real. So, does that help? Okay, personal and planetary evolution, have we done it? Have we brought it from nowhere to somewhere? All right. Okay, thank you all. God bless you. Yeah.